come here to get concerns. This is the subject on which I'm going to talk. The talk will consist of a few parts. In the first part, will be some general remarks on quantum noise, a subject that has been already discussed here quite a bit. I'll try to give you a pedagogical introduction to that subject from a point of view which is not completely conventional. In the second part, I discuss one important aspect of quantum fluctuations, which is the sensitivity to some parameters of the system, such as the volume, and from that follows the Casimir effect. And the Casimir effect is perhaps the first mesoscopic effect which would ever appear in the literature. It was done in 1948, something like that, by Casimir, of course. Now, what's the thing about zero-point fluctuations, which are the most quantum fluctuations? We know that if a system in the ground state, nothing can come out of it. The system cannot radiate out any energy because it's already in the ground state. The only way to send out anything, any signal, any energy, is by going to a lower state. And that's not available. So the system is dead. It's dead, but nevertheless it performs fluctuations. And we know that we can observe these fluctuations, and these fluctuations yield measurable effects. There is a whole lot of renormalization effects, mass renormalization of the electrons, for example, in the Lemschicht in atomic physics, etc., which are due to all sorts of second order higher processes in these fluctuations. So these fluctuations are very important. The Casimir force is a very important manifestation of these fluctuations. There has been some discussion recently in the literature about whether zero-point fluctuations can be phased or not, and I stand here and tell you very unequivocally that they cannot. And that's from the basic, very basic physics. They cannot, I'm not discussing. I'd be very happy to discuss it in a question period. So how do you observe the quantum noise? If you take a system which is in the ground state, it doesn't tell you anything. It doesn't send out any signal. You have to do something to the system. You have to tickle the system in order to see those fluctuations. And I'll discuss this tickling in more detail. So in the beginning, I'll just give pedagogical discussion of quantum noise, the physics of the power spectrum and its correlations. I'll talk about a generalization of the fluctuation dissipation or the Cooper theorem to a steady state non-equilibrium system. The third part I cannot have very much for, and actually it has been discussed quite a bit in this conference, Heisenberg constraints of quantum amplification. Maybe I'll say one or two words about it, but there'll be no time. And then I'll end by talking about the Casimir forces, which are an interesting measurable manifestation of quantum fluctuations. So we'll start with the first part. In classical physics, we understand very well what noise is. You have some quantity called x of t. And let's think about that very specifically. It's a current in some small circuit. And if you look at the current as a function of time, very permissible in classical physics, it's a function that may have a non-zero or zero average, doesn't matter, but it has fluctuations around the average. So there is a current as a function of time which you can register, and then you can look at these data and you can manipulate them. And one very important measure of these fluctuations is the correlation function. The average of x of t prime, which in a steady state and does not have an internal clock, is only a function of the difference of t prime minus t. In the system with time reversal symmetry, it's only a function of the absolute value of t minus t prime. So we understand everything about that. You read in classical books that you take the Fourier transform of the function of t minus t prime, and that's the power spectrum, that's the power parallelic frequency in these fluctuations. All that is very well known. The quantum system situation is a little bit more complicated because the quantity is an observable. You cannot plot an observable as a function of time because an observable has an infinite spectrum. You need an infinite number of axes for that, for example. So there is no C number that you can plot as a function of time. You might think about plotting the average expectation value, but for a stationary system, that average doesn't depend on time, so it's very, very boring. You may still look at the correlation function.
observed in two different times, and that really has all the information. Now we would want to analyze this correlation function a little bit more closely. And I'll start by restating the major difference between quantum and classical physics. In quantum physics, even the same operator does not commute with itself at different times. X of t prime is not equal to x of t prime, x of t. And this includes a system which is invariant to time reversal. Time reversal doesn't guarantee that these two things are not equal. And actually, they are generally not equal, and I'll show you examples when they're not equal. So this is a piece taken from Mandel Lifshitz. And they say that because this thing depends on whether you take t pi minus t or t minus t prime, let's say positive or negative time difference, then one must symmetrize this product and take this plus that over 2. That's actually a very strange statement, because there is no law of quantum physics telling you that any time two observables do not commute, you must take, and I insisted on the word must, you must take the symmetrized product. You never take the symmetrized product of x and p. Right? So if you do that, and that's commonly done in the literature, in many textbooks, you have thrown out some information. The information you have thrown out is basically the commutator. So this is the symmetrized product. We have thrown out the anti-symmetric part, which is the commutator. I'll show you, that you actually know already, but I sort of try to simplify it for you. I'll show you that commutator has a very important physical information, which you throw out if you close your eyes to the fact that there is not only the symmetrized part of the noise, but also the anti-symmetrized part of the noise. And I would say that maybe, and I try to convince you, the best thing is not to symmetrize and just skip the bare x of t prime, which is not symmetric, and it has all the information in it. Naturally, it will be shown to have a very interesting, very nice physical meaning and be measurable, and these measurements have been performed recently. And all that is, I think, becoming clearer and clearer. Now, what will be shown is that if you take the Fourier transform, exactly as you do in classical physics, but you take the Fourier transform of the full function, C of t pi minus t, no symmetrization, no nothing, you call the Fourier transform S of omega. In classical physics, it was called the power spectrum. Here, there is a power spectrum corresponding to one ordering and corresponding to the opposite ordering. This is related to the sine of omega, to the two branches of S of omega, with positive and negative omega. And in a few minutes, we'll understand the physical meaning of these two branches, and they will be seen to have distinct physical meanings. Both of them are observables, and they're observable under specific experiments. Now, in classical physics, the correlation function is real and symmetric. Here, there is no guarantee that it's even real. It may have an imaginary part, and actually, most of the times it does. And the only symmetry it satisfies is that C of t is equal to C of minus t complex conjugate. That's necessary for the power spectrum to be positive, as it must be. And because of that, also S of omega is not equal to S of minus omega. And a lot of people are very worried about it. They say, you know, we take a system which is invariant under time reversal, and here we have something which knows about the direction of time. And actually, this is very nice. It's actually very important for us to understand that, because it shows us that time irreversibility is actually built into the principles of this kind of physics. And in order to see it very clearly, it's very useful to take an exact expression for the power spectrum S of omega. Exact expression means mathematically Fourier transform this thing. How do you do that? Suppose I call this time 0 and this time just t. I write the Eisenberg operator here and there. I put a full state of a state, a full set of states here, some over them. And after a few lines of manipulation, I get an expression that I think Van Hoff was the first to have derived in a different context, saying that the power spectrum is the sum over the states of the system. It's a system having eigenstates, some Hamiltonian, and it's the probability to find the initial state, find the matrix element of the current. This is the quantity, the power spectrum of which I'm considering, squared, times the delta function. This is exact mathematical expression for the Fourier transform of the JT prime correlator. Now, when you look at that, you see that, for example, in equilibrium, which is not the most general situation, but it's a very important situation, omega and minus omega are related to changing pi to pj, you know, pf to pi to pf, initial and final states. Now, the population of initial and final states are related by Boltzmann factor, because pi is the Boltzmann factor e to the minus beta ei over the partition function. And from that, actually, Van Hoff was one of the first to say it very clearly, and he was worried about non-equilibrium and turning to equilibrium, that s omega is equal to s minus omega times the Boltzmann factor, which is very, very, a very, very deep relationship called the detailed balance relationship. And this relationship, for example, it shows you that if you couple two systems at different temperature, the energy will flow from the hotter system to the colder system. So this is a very deep relationship. And it manifestly tells you that in the simplest situation you can envisage, that in equilibrium, this function is not symmetric. And therefore, C of t is not real. And therefore, when you symmetrize, you throw out the imaginary part or the asymmetric part. And the asymmetric part is exactly the thing that ensures that the second law of thermodynamics will be valid. And boy, you really don't want to throw that out. So all that was advertisement for just bearing with me a few more minutes and not insisting on symmetrizing this noise power spectrum or temporal correlation function. By looking at this, you also see something very interesting, namely that only when h bar omega is much smaller than kT, which is the classical limit, there and only there will s of omega be approximately equal to s of minus omega. So in the classical limit where operators commute, you have this symmetry, but you have this symmetry only in the leading order in omega over kT, even in the deep classical limit. And the temperature is much larger than h bar omega, there is a slight reminder, this is not exactly valid. That reminder is actually of order h bar omega or kT. And we'll see in a few minutes that this is exactly the ability of even a classical system, or any system, to dissipate energy. Okay, so nobody protests so far. Now what's the meaning of the function s of omega? Let's take the specific example of a current in a circuit and couple the system to an electromagnetic field. And for simplicity, I take the wavelength of the electromagnetic field to be much larger than the size of my mesoscopic system. This is very good for even up to, say, far infrared mesoscopic systems. A factor R to A, the coupling is this. This is just the Q equals zero component of the current. And we see that the current is simply the operator. If I put my system in a classical electromagnetic field, this becomes a C number. And then the whole interaction between the system and the electromagnetic field is this JQ equals zero component of the current. That's exactly the thing that features, I'm sorry, in that Van Hoff formula for S of omega. So if you now look at this formula, in view of understanding that this is the coupling between the system and electromagnetic field, you see that S of omega is simply the rate of proportional to the rate of exchange of energy between the electromagnetic field and the system. Very, very simple. That's the golden rule. And there are constants in front of this. One of them is A squared, which is the field squared. No, the field is A dot, is I omega A. So what we have learned? We have learned that the sine of omega actually tells us whether we emit energy into the field or absorb energy from the field. And certainly they are not equal. The emission absorption cross section are not equal. This is, for example, evident in the Einstein relationships and so on and so forth. And this basic asymmetry is the thing which is there always. And the sine of omega is relevant. And it's very customary to symmetrize the correlation function, but if you do that, you would throw out the difference, which is responsible, for example, to the ratio between the A and B in the Einstein formula, which as we know is very, very important. And that's actually the reason why temperature zero system, it means nothing that it can absorb. So the emission, for positive omega, the emission is S of omega. The absorption is S of minus omega in general. And if I drive the system with a huge number of photons, classical field, N omega is much, much, much larger than one. You get three times, you know, not just three times. You find that the net absorption is proportional to S of omega minus S omega. In other words, to the asymmetric part of the power spectrum. And the absorption rate is proportional to the conductance. Hence, the conductance is proportional to S minus omega minus S omega over omega, which is something we know and love. This is the Kumar formula. Because this is simply the Fourier transform of the temporal current-current correlation function. And we all know that this is what Kumar has told us. So, A, we managed to really get a good, very good understanding of the Kumar formula, but we managed a little bit more than that, for the fluctuation dissipation theorem. We managed to see that it's very, more generally than Kumar himself has derived it. I consider the equilibrium case as a particular case, but nowhere have I really assumed that the system must be in equilibrium. All I have assumed about the system is that the system is eigenstates, eigenfunction, eigenenergies, and I know the probability pi to find the system in state I. I.e., I assumed that the density matrix of the system is diagonal in the energy representation. So the system is in a stationary state. So if a system in a stationary non-equilibrium state, which is a far more general situation than equilibrium, will satisfy the Kumar formula. And it will satisfy the Kumar formula in the following sense. You drive the system with some large, not necessarily small field. You let the system go into a steady state. Now you tickle the system with some AC field, frequency omega. That must be small because it's the linear response to the small field. And that linear response in the tickling frequency omega will satisfy the generalized fluctuation dissipation theorem. So I think this is quite an interesting, very interesting thing. I think it's very deeply connected with some relationships that are called the fluctuation theorems that, as far as I know, were first written down in this country by Evans and Sarles, which looked at the probability to make a fluctuation upward and downward. And upward and downward, as you see, smells very much like my ratio between S omega and S minus omega. So it's one of the few results in non-equilibrium physics that we really have. And I repeat, because I think it's important, we need just a steady state system in order to establish this fluctuation dissipation theorem. So this was the first sort of pedagogical part of my talk. I'm saying again, the noise power is the ability of the system to exchange energy in the electromagnetic field. There is a recent experiment by Bloch et al. Confirming observation of the non-symmetrized noise. I have personally a very interesting motivation for all this, which are the experiments that observe fractional charge of quasi-particles with short noise. And one way to understand how this is possible is to understand that when you look at finite frequency noise, what you really measure is not the current fluctuations, but the electromagnetic fields emitted by those currents. Once you understand it, it's very easy to understand how a small system, finite system, which is coupled to large classical wires, can still show its intrinsic quasi-particle noise. Okay, the next subject is this amplification process, which I won't have much time to go into, except to tell you that our generalization of the fluctuation dissipation theorem is very useful to generalize some of the basic Heisenberg inequalities, like the average noise power delivered to the load, from bosonic currents to fermionic currents, because the fermionic currents, you don't have technically the right relationship between commutators, but you have. But if this FDT tells you, skip all this, tells you the average of the commutators, and knowing the average of the commutators is enough to establish these Heisenberg inequalities. This is a very nice observation by Uri Gavish, ex-PhD student who really did this that part. So I will now go to the last part. The last part is really something which I think is fascinating from the point of view of fundamental physics, and actually it's very, very basic in nanoscience, and it's even important for applications, as I will show you. And what's the basic question? The basic question is that, you know, whether we want it or not, we are living here and we are surrounded by huge fluctuations of all the physical fields that exist in vacuum. Even if you had lived in vacuum, the vacuum has, for example, electromagnetic fields. These electromagnetic fields exist, the zero-point fluctuation of them exists up to the Planck scale, which is a huge energy. If you calculate the energy density of the zero-point fluctuations of the electromagnetic field, it's something like 10 to the 120 in any unit unit. Once you go to such power, it doesn't matter if you measure it in electron volts or in degrees. It's more than 100 orders of magnitude larger than any scale of energy density that you might think about. So, you know, why one might feel a little bit threatened. You know, I'm moving here quite slowly, but you know, I'm moving in this soup of incredibly high energy density. Now, we are used to that. Actually, the reason our mass is like what it is, and not the unrenormalized mass, is because of that. There are a lot of things that happen because of that. But all that is kind of semi-philosophical. How can you observe that, you know, in a brutal, down-to-earth way? Mr. Casimir, actually motivated by experiment done at Phillips in the 40s, something like that, reached this idea. It's a really a beautiful idea. And he calculated, after some other machinations, he calculated the force that just exists between two conducting plates placed a mesoscopic distance, distance d apart. When d goes to infinity, of course, this force goes to zero, because this is manifestly mesoscopic effect. I don't know if Mike Rukes is here, but this is a picture taken from his paper with the Yale books, and they found a nice French book on marine technology, L'Albume du Marin, from 1836, showing that if two vessels come very close to each other, you now understand it's due to Casimir effect of surface waves, they are mysteriously attracted to each other, and it says sometimes with various unhappy outcomes. And this is apparently, there's been papers written on this, that this is due to the same reason as the ordinary Casimir force. So it is very, very interesting because it's a basic effect. It's also important because it's the same as the van der Waals force. It's a force that exists just because of fluctuations to different pieces of anything, in vacuum or not in vacuum. It can be, of course, generalized to finite temperatures, etc. It's very, very interesting. And let's review very quickly what Casimir did, and then try to understand that and make some new comments on it. So we said, okay, let's calculate the energy of the electromagnetic field between such plates. These are two metallic plates, a distant d apart. So it's very, very simple. You take the formula for the C over 2 times K. K is the K pair is one parallel to the plates, which is not a good notation. N pi over D is the mode of the electromagnetic field in between the plates. Square root of the sum of the squares is K. So H bar C, K over 2. It's just the energy of such a zero-point force. You have to integrate it over k. You have to sum it over n. And that sum will give you the total energy of the zero of the electromagnetic field. Now, this energy, of course, diverges. This is a typical divergence of field theory. Now, basically, this divergence is cut off at the Planck scale. But we are talking about real physics. And he pointed out that the divergence is really cut off at the plasma frequency of the metal, because above the plasma frequency, the metal is not there. The waves don't even know that it is there, so it's not relevant. So we have to cut it off. In addition, he found out that in order to get a meaningful result, you have to subtract something. Here is a very tricky business. And subtractions are sort of the core of many such calculations. And sometimes you wonder, you know, what is this idea? I take an infinite quantity, I subtract another infinite quantity, get the finite quantity, but this doesn't sound fair. You know, I can change one of the infinite quantities a little bit, the gender result. So he very ingeniously subtracted the end, some argument for that, the energy, same energy from D equal infinity, then you get a finite, very well defined result. You take the derivative of that with respect to D, and you derive a force. And this is the very well known, beautiful Casimir force. It depends only on natural constant H bar C, pi, and 240. You're guessing natural constant in some sense. So it doesn't depend on anything. It doesn't depend on whether these plates are made of zinc or copper or any other conductor. It doesn't depend even on the cutoff. It doesn't depend on the plasma frequency of those materials. It's very, very interesting. And this result was sitting there for some years. And then slowly, experimentally started to gear up to measuring it, and they devised a few ways to measure it. And I just tell you that it agreed with the experiment within a few percent, which are thought to be the results of finite temperature and surface roughness of the metals. Now, how to understand the subtraction, the Casimir subtraction? I think the physical way to understand it is to say the whole thing is simply a balance of radiation pressures. You have the radiation pressure of the vacuum in between the plates, the green vacuum, and you have the radiation pressure from the outside of the red vacuum. And of course, the net force of each plate, of this plate, for example, is the difference between this one and that one. And each of them is the derivative of the energy of those guys with respect to me. This is kind of the obvious idea. I was very glad when I understood it. And there, of course, I found there were a couple of other people, Gonzalez, Lumi et al., Ashwater, who had it before. You follow this, and this is really, I think, the right physical way to understand all the questionable parts of Casimir's calculation. And it's very easy to confirm that you can do it in two different ways, they all give you the same results. But now there is a slight generalization which I'd like to emphasize to you. What happens if, for example, we put the electric material in between the plates? Now, it's very easy to see how the energy of the mold is renormalized. You just work it out and you find that the result for the pressure is renormalized in the following way. Within a certain integral that appears in Casimir calculation, you have the electric functional frequency per power 3/2. And because of that, you find that his result for the pressure becomes something else. Actually, there is no, just the pressure of either of the finite modes is h bar p omega p to the fourth. This does depend on, this no longer universal, it depends on the cutoff, and depends on some weighted average of the light velocity due to this dielectric function. That's not going into more technical details. It's non-universal. It depends on the nature of the slab, depends on the electric function, you know, things like that. And what it tells you is that the material with a larger dielectric function will have a larger radiation pressure than the material with a smaller dielectric function. So, now, of course, you have to be careful, because if you put this in material, it will be also sensitive to elastic forces. But if you make even a configuration of one plate like that, if all of a sudden you change the dielectric properties either of the plate or of the dielectric, for example, by making this form semiconductor and putting perpendicular in this direction radiation in the gap frequency, you have a finite motion of the thing sideways. So you can have, I call this the macroscopic Casimir effect, just on one plate. You can, of course, also have a such thing between two plates. And these forces are not so small. The scale, which is making cheating for this, is 0.1 Newton per centimeter squared, but that's for a constant dielectric function. To take into account the fact that dielectric functions usually go to one, some small frequency. But for water, it turns out that water and air, this force is about 10^-6, 10^-5 of this scale. It's a small force, but it's larger than forces that have already been measured in the Casimir physics. So the dielectric inside between the two plates can turn the large enough distances, the Casimir attraction, into repulsion. I'm not selling this as a part of applied physics, but it's very important, actually. This is not a solution, it's quite important to convert the attraction to repulsion, because the attraction leads to something called stiction,
which kills most nanomechanical devices. Another nice result is that you can also look at surface plasmons on a single metallic plate and find that just the surface plasmons give you a positive inward pressure on the metallic plate, which is again a constant times the plasma frequency over dq. And that's not a small pressure, it's probably quite a large pressure, especially for very thin films. So to summarize what I said about the Casimir force, first of all, there is nothing intimidating about these vacuum fluctuations. They are there. They only depend on the low frequency part of the spectrum. They lead to measurable effects. The Casimir force is one measurable effect. It's possible to alter the Casimir force with the electrics. I think we can understand the subtractions and all the ways to get a finite result in the Casimir effect physically. That makes one feel much better. And finally, anything will give you, has zero point motions. So it's not only photons or phonons, the way acoustic waves also need Casimir forces, but also plasmons, also polaritons. All the things that we know and love in condensed matter physics have zero point fluctuations. If these zero point fluctuations depend on the distance, you have a force. One example is a force operating on a metallic field. So I conclude here.
Well, we're just a bit into injury time, so we can have one question, I think.
Thanks for that. The results you just quoted with the surface plasmons, I understood you related to repulsion.
Well, repulsion means that if I have a metallic plate in vacuum, the vacuum from both sides will repel, will put a finite force on the metal plate and try to squeeze it even more.
So there's an effect.
Yeah, it goes like that. And actually, it's in the same category as some forces that have been calculated by Lifshitz.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. In fact, Lifshitz and Linen are claimed to check it.
It's another way of saying this, but it's another variation. It's useful to know that it's due to the zero point energy of plasmons, surface plasmons.
Well, we should get on with the next talk. Let's thank Professor Emmanuel.